a sermon by Reverend Richard A. Ram, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on March 5, 1995, in the series The Dream, entitled Retrieving a Dangerous Dream. The scripture reading is Luke 22, verses 14 through 34, and the text for the sermon is Luke 22, verse 19. Copyright Grand Valley State University.
My life and ministry has been changed through the observance of Lent. It's in the observance of Lent that I began to focus rather intensely on the story of Jesus. And in the last few years, that focus for me has been transforming. I grew up in the church and in a wonderful Christian home and was taught as a child to love Jesus, and I was taught the whole story of Jesus and identified Jesus as Son of God, the one who came into this world to die for us, and my piety, I suppose, was expressed in the old hymn, Jesus paid it all to him I owe. Sin had left a dreadful stain. He washed it white as snow. Then I began to realize that while I should love Jesus and admire and trust and adore Jesus, as a matter of fact, there were people in the course of history that moved me more than Jesus. Strange thing to confess to you, but it's true. It began to bother me somewhat, and I began to ask the question, why do I go through the motions, and why do I say all the right things about Jesus Christ, but why is it that, as a kid having to do a book review on a biography, I read a biography of Gandhi, maybe in the fourth or fifth or sixth grade, I don't know, and I was so impressed with that person. And then later, maybe studying the whole Civil War and recognizing the leadership of an Abraham Lincoln, I was really impressed. And in the 60s, with the civil rights struggle, Martin Luther King and the leadership, the nonviolent leadership patterned on Gandhi's methods, I was moved by this human person. Began to realize that Jesus did not affect me the way some of these people affected me. And then it was such that in the study of the Gospels, there was a development or a kind of a movement that looked at Christology from below. See, my Christology, my understanding of Jesus Christ was from above, from God's point of view. That's the way you've learned it too. I can remember struggling with that at some points. For example, in seminary, now most of you haven't been to seminary. You're very fortunate. But in seminary, you study, for example, Christology. And I can remember studying that section in the Gospels about the temptations, you know, where Jesus was tempted in the wilderness. And according to our theological system, good Reformed theology, Jesus was really tempted, but Jesus could not have sinned. Now, maybe you didn't know that, but believe me, that's true. In our good theological systems, Jesus is tempted, but Jesus could not sin. Jesus was not only human, Jesus was divine. If Jesus Christ, human and divine, had sinned, God would have sinned. That's impossible. So the temptation was real, but Jesus could not have sinned. When it came to exam time, I had to write the answer to the question, could Jesus have sinned? So I wrote the right answer. Because uppermost in my life was always to get all A's. So my father had taught me that, you know. So I wrote the right answer. But then I wrote what I really felt. And I let the professor have it. I mean, the page smoked. And I said, it disgusts me, this kind of games we play. When you read the gospel story and you've got Jesus in the wilderness in temptation, and then we later come and observe that and we say, oh, he could not really have sinned. And I really, you know, I got rid of all my passion. And I got my exam book back and the professor wrote across my answer, feel better? And indeed, I did feel better. Well, so there were those times I can remember when I struggled with the fact that my Jesus Christ was second person of the Trinity, Son of God, come down to earth to live and to die, to take care of the atoning necessity and to go back to reign. And I treated Jesus Christ as a kind of divine interloper, one who dipped down here for a time. But Jesus for me lacked something of that flesh and blood passion that I experienced in my own human experience. He was not really my brother, I'm sorry. And I was more impressed by Gandhi, because to be sure, Jesus was pretty heroic. But after all, he had a leg up on us. And then that development of Christology from below, where there began to be some research into the real historical setting of Jesus. And as I began to reflect on that, I came to see that God certainly embodied Jesus, or Jesus was embodied with the Spirit of God, but Jesus was my brother. Jesus was flesh of my flesh and bone of my bone. And then I began to reflect on the whole gospel story from that angle. And on April 15, 1984, Palm Sunday, I preached a sermon here entitled, Jesus, You're Really Somebody. And it was a turning point for me. I was invited to come to Western Seminary to lead a Lenten preaching seminar. And so there were about 40 or 50 of my colleagues gathered there, and I shared with them my excitement about how my preaching during the Lenten season had come alive with my understanding of Jesus as genuinely human. Well, it wasn't very well accepted, frankly. But no matter. I continued to pursue that line until in 1991 during Lent, preached about the way of Jesus, the sign of the cross, the way of Jesus. And then the next year, the same thing. And the next year, the way of Jesus, the way of the cross, the way of a human being fully open to God, who proclaimed a different world and who died for the way he lived. And I come right back in 1995, and I want to say in these Lenten weeks that Jesus had a dream. He had a dream of a new world, of a different way of being. And in dying, he asked those who followed him to remember, to keep the dream alive. And so this morning, we begin with the retrieval of a dangerous dream. Retrieval is a technical word. If you were in literary circles and if you were engaged in the interpretation of literary documents of the past, which of course is very critical to the interpretation of the Bible, it's very critical to the interpretation of the Constitution, but it's also done broadly in the literary field, interpretation of documents of the past. How do you bridge the past and the present? The endeavor to do that is called the science of hermeneutics. Hermes was the messenger of the gods. Hermes was the god of communication. How do you take an ancient story and have it come alive so that it impacts us today, shaping our future? Well, in the study of literary documents in today's world, which is quite a broad endeavor being carried on by many, many people, there is what is called the hermeneutics of suspicion. You go to an ancient document and you don't just take it at face value, but you say, what was going on? What was going on in the society, in the culture? What was the political situation, the economic situation? Why would this author have put things this way? Maybe the clearest example of this in the New Testament is in the hermeneutics of suspicion. The interpreter will go to the Gospel of John, where you have this awful controversy between Jesus and the Jews. And the interpreter will go and he will say, at that time when John was writing, there was real conflict between the Jesus movement and the ongoing Jewish community. There was real tension. And that tension will probably reveal itself in a document written at that time. So the hermeneutics of suspicion doesn't just take it at face value, but it says what was going on behind there. But there's another hermeneutics, and that's what I really want to use in our Lenten discussions, and that is the hermeneutics of retrieval, where there is an honest effort made to retrieve, to bring back, to elicit from the past that meaning, that disclosure, in order that it may become a disclosure experience for us today. The kind of thing when you read an ancient document out of another time and another place and a whole other world, and suddenly a light goes on, and that which came to expression there comes to expression again. That's retrieval. And what I hope we can do, and where we want to begin this morning, is to try to retrieve that dream of Jesus. It's more possible to do it today than has ever been true before, because there's been such intensive research into the Gospels and into the life of Jesus. One of the books that some of you have read and we've passed around is a book by Marcus Borg, Meeting Jesus Again for the First Time. Marcus Borg is a member of the Jesus Seminar that gets a little press once in a while. Marcus Borg makes a very interesting and I think helpful distinction. The pre-Easter Jesus and the post-Easter Jesus. They're not the same, you see. The pre-Easter Jesus is the Jesus that lived, ate, slept, sweat, taught, wept. The actual, historical Jesus. Pre-Easter Jesus. The post-Easter Jesus is that Jesus remembered after Easter. Remembered some decades down the line. Remembered in terms of the present experience of the risen living Christ. Our Gospels are post-Easter Jesus remembrances. But through research today, we have access more than ever before to that pre-Easter Jesus. Studying his times, studying his cultural situation. What was the politics of the day? What were the economics of the day? Does it matter, for example, that Jesus was at the lower end of the peasant scale, that Jesus' family had lost their property? Does it help us to understand Jesus if we understand in that day that life was organized according to a kind of holiness code where you ate with some people and you didn't eat with other people? You followed certain practices in your diet and your ritual life. There were all sorts of ways in which life was structured then, just as is true now. But what we're able to do now is to go back and paint some of that, understand some of that that was going on. So we're looking at the pre-Easter Jesus. But to remember Jesus is to recover a dangerous dream. Because Jesus is not just the pre-Easter Jesus of history. Jesus is the living Lord of the church. And throughout all of these centuries, here and there, now and again, someone or some movement has remembered, has been captivated by the memory of Jesus, and it has energized them and changed them, and they've become transformative agents in the world. For example, in the Second World War in France, when the Nazis overcame the French government, there was a French government put in place that was a puppet government that cooperated with the Nazis and cooperated with the Nazis specifically in rousing out the Jews and sending them off to the concentration camps. There was a French Reformed pastor named André Trocmé. His story is told in the book Lest Innocent Blood Be Shed. Trocmé struggled with what he as a Christian had to do in the face of his context and time in France. Should he cooperate? He could not cooperate. But the thing that shaped Trocmé in his very concrete decisions in that very existential situation was his memory of Jesus. He writes, "If Jesus really walked upon the earth, why do we keep treating him as if he were a disembodied, impossible, idealistic ethical theory?" You see, if Jesus is just some kind of impossible ideal, then Jesus can be admired, but not necessarily followed. I mean, we're only human. Trocmé says, if he was a real man, then the Sermon on the Mount was made for people on this earth. And if he existed, God has shown us in flesh and blood what goodness is for flesh and blood people. What's dangerous to remember Jesus that way? Because it put Trachme in danger of his life. But it's dangerous in a deeper sense. It's dangerous to the collaborationist government. It's dangerous to the ruling regime. The memory of Jesus is subversive. When Jesus gets a hold of one, when one says, "Oh, I see a different world. I see a new possibility. I see the contradiction of my life. I see the contradiction of my society, of my church." When one is energized by that dream, that memory, one can become a dangerous person. One becomes a destabilizing person then. One becomes as Jesus was, a thorn in the flesh of the status quo and the established structures of life. Jesus' memory is dangerous, but it is precisely in the Lenten season that we are called to remember. And how better to enter the season than around the table of our Lord, the Last Supper. As I sat at the table, it was His custom to eat with people, to eat with all people. To eat with all people was a political statement. It was counter to the accepted ways, the conventional wisdom. It was radical and it was disruptive. People were offended by Jesus. Particularly the religious people were offended with Jesus. When He came to His last night, it was as natural as breathing for Him to say to His disciples, "Join me at table." And knowing that He was going to die, it was inevitable. He broke the bread and He said to them, "Remember me. Don't let the dream die." That's really what it was. It was really no more than that. The dream has so many applications, and we can't begin even to scratch the surface this morning, but let me just give you a concrete illustration of what it would mean if we remembered Jesus at the table. This table, my friends, is here because Jesus gathered at table. And Jesus gathered at table with all sorts of people. He scandalized the righteous because He would break bread with anybody. But this table in congregations and churches all across the world, rather than being the table of Jesus that invites all, has become one of the great divisions even within the Christian church. There are Christian churches that gather, and I'm not allowed to come to the table because I don't believe just the way they believe, or believe and live just the way they believe and live, or recite just the right words. Isn't it ironic? Isn't it ironic that the table, which for Jesus was the radical sign of inclusivity, could become a means of division even among Christian people? And the table, which was a sign of inclusivity, was simply a sign of that broader inclusivity of Jesus who welcomed all, who ate with publicans and tax collectors, accepted the devotion of a prostitute, reached out and touched the leper.
And yet the church of walls and barriers. It is not simply the people who are hungry for grace and forgiveness. We have our walls up and our barriers erected. Isn't it ironic? If we really remembered the dream, it could be dangerous. Couldn't it? For the Christian church. For my life. That's what this season is all about. Remembering that Jesus died because he had a dream of something different. Remembering that world that he conceived of, a world of grace, of compassion, of inclusiveness. And then seeking in this season to be transformed by the memory in order to keep the dream alive. Lent has changed my life and my ministry. I love Jesus, and it is the passion of my life to follow him. Will you join me?